We cannot accept a system in which shareholders make money on these operations if the bank wins, but taxpayers foot the bill if the bank loses.
Hello and welcome to NPR's Planet Money. I'm Adam Davidson.
And I'm Alex Bloomberg. That was President Barack Obama, you heard at the top of the program, announcing his new plan for regulating the financial system.
And we'll have more on that later in the program. But first, Alex, I see that you have brought in a gold box, the Planet Money Indicator.
Dun-da-da-da. The Planet Money Indicator is 43 plus 1.
All right, I'm going to take the 43 first. That's the number of states that had their unemployment rates increase in December. So 43 states have higher unemployment. That's according to the new government numbers released today.
And the plus one, that is the District of Columbia. The unemployment rate also went up there. The rate went down in only four states, and in three states it stayed the same. So this officially counts as more bad news on the employment front.
Although it might have some tiny trickle of good news because more people were participating, more people were looking for work. So maybe that hints that more people think the economy is doing better.
Possibly.
But basically, this is far worse news than people had expected we'd be experiencing at this time. And that could explain the wave of anger and discontent that swept a little-known Republican to a Senate victory in Massachusetts.
Which in turn could explain why President Obama has been acting a little feistier when it comes to dealing with Wall Street. In the last month, he unveiled a proposal to levy a special tax on the biggest banks to pay back the money that the government is expected to lose through the bailout programs.
And then just yesterday, he unleashed a bit of a bombshell. It's so far all we have is a one-page press release, but it promises much tougher regulations on the financial industry, regulations that have been advocated by former Fed Chairman Paul Volcker, among others. He pledged to work with Congress to limit the size of banks.
And also to limit the activities that banks can engage in. In essence, he wants to pass laws that say if you're a bank or a bank holding company, you can no longer own or invest in a hedge fund, a private equity fund, or run a proprietary trading operation.
Now, Alex, I sit next to you, and I happen to know you are a man obsessed with this prop trading, proprietary trading that the banks engage in. I've never fully understood your obsession, but now I'm glad you have it since it's front page news.
Well, you hear a lot about it. And on the one side, people say it's banks gambling for their own profit with your money and my money and anybody who's deposited money in the bank. And then you'll talk to others who say it's a ridiculous distinction. There's nothing inherently bad about prop trading. And now here, regulations are coming out to potentially ban it. So I wanted to talk with someone who could help us think this through. And I got a guy named Andrew Lowe on the line. He's a professor at the MIT Sloan School of Management and an author of many, many books on financial markets and institutions. And I just started off by asking him, okay, if you're a proprietary trader at a bank, what do you do?
You're basically trying to make money funds from the bank or the financial institution. You're betting with house money. And you're trying to make money in a variety of different markets in much the same way that a hedge fund would try to make money for its investors.
So and as I understand, hedge funds have different strategies. Some of them are simply, you know, they have a view on how stocks are going to go. And so they're basically buying and selling stocks according to some plan that they have. And so they borrow a whole bunch of money and they say, we're going to pick stocks, basically, better than everybody else, better than the market, and we're going to get high returns. Others are investing in mortgage-backed securities, for example, or investing in emerging markets or whatever, right? So a hedge fund is sort of, the idea is it takes people's money and then it says, I have a strategy for increasing that money, and mm-hmm. I'm gonna use it. So what is the difference between that and a proprietary desk at a bank?
Really no difference at all other than where the capital comes from. A proprietary trading desk is trying to do exactly the same thing. They start out with a pile of money, and they just want to make that pile grow bigger. And they're engaging in lots of different activities across various different markets in order to do that. The main difference is that proprietary traders get their capital from the financial institution or the bank, whereas a hedge fund will get its money from investors in the fund.
So in other words, the proprietary trader is getting its money from me. I have a savings account at a bank, so that's they're using my money versus I am not an investor in a hedge fund.
Well, partly yes, they can use your deposits or part of it for that activity, but they could also be using corporate profits. So when they make money for their shareholders, they could be using some of that money to engage in proprietary trading.
Mm-hmm. And what about Fed money?
Well, you know, to the extent that Fed money was provided to banks to give them more liquidity, yes, they could be using some of those funds in order to trade.
Right. I guess that's the situation that seems different, is if I'm an investor in a hedge fund, I know that I am taking my hard-earned gazillion or money and giving it to people, and that there's a risk that they're not going to – they could be lying in the case of Bernie Madoff, or they could be involved in the wrong strategy or whatever. I know I'm taking a risk with my money, and I'm giving it to very smart people, and I'm hoping that they know something that the rest of the market doesn't. But I also know if they don't get it back to me, it's gone. Mm-hmm. Whereas my money that I give to Chase Bank, I'm putting it in there because I know that money is going to come back to me. It's guaranteed by the government, and the same with Fed money. So it seems a little bit weird. I guess that's the impetus for this rule, to disallow banks to use, you know, insured deposits or to use, you know, other types of government guaranteed money for their own, you know, internal hedge funds.
Well, you know, I certainly think that it's a reason to be more careful and deliberative about what banks can and cannot do. Anytime you're dealing with depositor funds, I think one has to think about the risks in a different way. You really have to answer to a higher standard when you're dealing with the public. And so I think that's why we have so many rules that govern and constrain what banks can do versus what a hedge fund can do. But having said that, at the same time, we have to recognize that proprietary trading has a number of positive benefits, which if we end up constraining it, we will have to face those consequences.
So what are those positive benefits? I think that's one of the things, like, it's easy to understand, hey, they're gambling with my money. You know, that's a very easy thing to understand from somebody who's not an expert point of view. Why do I want some trader picking stocks with my deposits? Why is that good?
Well, you know, let's go through a simple example. You know, you put your money in a bank, and the bank is allowed to take some of those deposits, not all of them, but some of them, a pretty large chunk, in fact, and make other uses, take other uses with the funds. For example, they're allowed to make loans with your deposit. And that's generally considered a good thing because when they make loans, they're actually providing liquidity to the marketplace. People who need those funds, who want to start new businesses, who want to send their kids to college, they will need that money, and a bank will provide those funds and earn interest on it and therefore be able to be profitable.
Right. I give the bank $100. It takes 90 of those dollars, loans it to a small business person to, you know, open a new factory. That factory is productive. They pay the bank back a big interest, 6% interest, and then the bank pays me 3% interest. Mm-hmm. Everybody's happy. In the perfect ideal model, that's how it should work, right? Okay.
Right, exactly. The bank's betting that when it makes that loan of the $90, that it will get back the $90 plus interest. So in a way, the bank has already taken a position in a risky venture.
Wait a minute. The bank is gambling with my money.
Exactly. But as long as the gamble pays off, more often than not, everybody's happy.
Right.
And so proprietary trading is really just another form of that kind of betting. The bank is betting instead of on a new business with a loan, maybe they're betting on the U.S. dollar. Maybe they're betting on mortgage-backed securities. Maybe they're betting on the stock market, or maybe they're betting on convertible arbitrage. So they're engaging in a number of different productive uses of the money.
See, that word productive uses, I feel like that's another place that we run into trouble is that I can understand, oh, yeah, I want the small business person to get a loan. So I don't necessarily care if I have an understanding of how the bank works in the first place, which I think is a big F. But say I do, I'm happy that there's a small business person getting a loan with my money and that the economy is growing. But the reality is a proprietary trader is maybe involved in some sort of crazy flash trading scheme that I've read about maybe somewhere or like saw some news report about that I don't understand and that seems like simply the bank and the trader can get rich, but no small business person is getting a loan out of it.
Well, so I think this is a very important point that really requires a little bit more thought because when you actually think about what a proprietary trader is doing, keep in mind that, you know, given that we have a relatively robust and free economy, every buyer has a seller and every seller has a buyer. In other words, a trade doesn't happen unless two mutually consenting adults agree to it. And when they agree to it, that must mean that there's a reason for doing the trade. So in the example that you cited where you're providing a small business loan to create jobs, In the same way, a proprietary trader who's trading some fancy securities or engaging in high-frequency trading, they're actually providing liquidity to the marketplace. They're providing sort of the buying and the selling in order to allow business to grow.
All right,
and
now,
that's a very important part of the economy.
And I'm going to jump in here. And just the minute somebody says a phrase, they are providing liquidity.
Yeah.
Joe, 90% intelligent guy who cares about this stuff but doesn't really, you've lost him. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I feel like that is the great problem with this. So what is that? Why do I care? I don't care. Providing liquidity, I don't even care about that. What does that mean?
So this is a great point, and it's a really important one that I think everybody can understand very easily. So let me give you an example. Suppose that you just got a job in another city, and it's a great job. You've been looking for it. It's a promotion. The only problem is that you need to move within the next 2 weeks, and you've got to sell a house. Now, if you need to sell a house in 2 weeks, literally you have to close in 2 weeks, you can bet that you're going to take a big hit on the value of that home.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, if this new job has with it the ability to be flexible and you don't need to move in 2 weeks, you can move in, let's say, 3 months, then there's a much better chance that you'll be able to sell the house at a more reasonable price. The difference between selling the house right away versus selling it in 3 months, that has to do with liquidity. If you can't sell something very quickly, the only way that you can unload it is by taking a big hit. That's not a very good situation. And so when we talk about the importance of liquidity, providing liquidity, it's really saying that there are lots of people out there that are willing to buy and sell. It's sort of like on eBay. You know, when you've got lots of bidders for a particular commodity, you're likely to get a better price than if nobody's bidding on it or if it's just one person. And so the question is, do you want to have a market, an eBay, with lots and lots of participants, or do you want to only have one or two? The idea behind proprietary trading is we want to have a more robust kind of eBay for financial markets.
Right. And so in that house example, if there was somebody who was like, sure, I'll buy your house at closer to the market rate right now because I'm pretty sure I have a whole bunch of houses in my portfolio and I'm buying and selling houses all the time and I can see what your house is actually worth in a regular marketplace. So I'll just buy your house from you right now and then I'll sell it down the road and I'll make my money back. And so what you're saying is, if you substitute stocks for houses or weird securities for houses, that is what a proprietary trader is doing. So what are you worried about then? I mean, if this is all just a good thing, why should we even worry about it?
Well, I think the worry is that proprietary trading can get involved in some very, very complex kinds of risks. And, in the example that we started with where a bank is making a small business loan to a shopkeeper who's going to start a new bakery or something, we understand pretty well what those risks are. But when you start engaging in very esoteric and complex trading strategies, the risks become much more difficult to manage. And, once again, when you're dealing with depositors, I think we need to have a higher standard of care regarding the kinds of risks that we put their money at. And so that's the concern, that if proprietary trading grows too quickly and in many complex ways, then we won't have enough time to really understand the potential risks that we're creating within the financial system.
And if I could summarize, I think I have a way of summarizing your position, which tell me if I'm right. The problem with proprietary trading is not that the bank is taking my money and gambling with it, because the bank is essentially always taking my money and gambling with it. The problem, if there is a problem with proprietary trading, is in the shopkeeper example, the bank basically knows what the odds are. And in the proprietary trading arena, sometimes the bank thinks it knows what the odds are, but actually it doesn't know what the odds are.
Exactly. And what's even worse, the government doesn't necessarily know what the odds are, and yet the government is on the hook if things go wrong. So in my view, if the government and hence the taxpayer, if you and I are going to be footing the bill when things go wrong, then I think that we have a responsibility and the right to know exactly what those risks are and to be able to manage them appropriately.
One other question, which is, I'm a bank. I've got all these different operations going on. I know that one of my clients is about to do something with their money. They're about to buy a whole bunch of stock in something or sell a whole bunch of stock. Or I know that one of my clients is about to do something. What's to stop me from taking that information that I know and then using it to my advantage on the prop trading desk?
You know, that's a great point, and something that obviously a number of individuals and institutions have worried about, the implicit conflict of interest when you've got an organization that's engaged in multiple lines of business. So, of course, what we've done over time in our regulatory infrastructure is to create separations between business lines. These are so-called Chinese walls that are set up between different units of a financial institution, and they're not allowed to communicate over those Chinese walls. On occasion, I think those Chinese walls are more like Japanese walls, you know, made out of rice paper instead of stone. And I think that's a genuine concern.
And the Chinese wall actually didn't stop anything either. Apparently, there was a gigantic failure as well.
certainly had
to tell you. Yeah,
that's right. Exactly. So I think that there are some issues. And this is why I think we need to spend more time thinking about the underlying causes of the financial crisis and why we really need to create a kind of a national transportation safety board to study the problems with the financial system and to sift through the wreckage and really document what happened, how it happened, why it happened, and what needs to be done on a systemic level to make sure that it doesn't happen again.
So, Alex, listening to your interview with Andrew Lowe, here's my question. I just don't have an answer right now. Has the politics fundamentally changed, do you think? I mean, the basic take that it seems has been in place for the last year has been, yes, there's an appetite for more regulation, but there's not an appetite in Washington, even if there certainly is one in the rest of the country, there's not an appetite among Democrats or Republicans in power to really fundamentally challenge the banks. The basic thing, it seems to me, is the average person probably wants them to be quote-unquote tough on banks, but they don't know enough about – I mean, banking regulation is so complicated that there's not some popular call for any specific thing. So I just wonder, does this mean the fundamental politics have shifted, or is this just going to – sort of be watered down day by day by bank lobbyists and the general legislative process?
Well, I mean, I think it's definitely going to be watered down, I'm sure. But I do think that something has probably changed in that, you know, if it's 60-40 in the Senate and you're trying to get something passed, your strategy is, okay, I'm going to try to get something that 60 of the senators in my party can agree on, and I'm just going to get that passed. And so that looks one way. But if the balance of power shifts just a little bit in the Senate, then maybe a different strategy is to be like, okay, I'm going to go tougher, and since there's going to be a filibuster anyway, I'm going to make people filibuster something that, you know, most of my constituents would support more. So I think it might be that maybe that's the calculation, is that I'm more likely to get something if I can shame the other side into backing down. Maybe. I don't know.
I have such a hard time understanding economics. I feel like we're barely getting our handle on that. But politics is, to me, just so much more confusing. I will say we did call Scott Talbot, our favorite banking lobbyist, at the Financial Services Roundtable. He lobbies for the 100 largest financial firms in the country. You'll be shocked to learn. Not a big fan of Obama's proposal.
Right.
But says that there's not a lot of details yet. They're going to be working closely with the administration and Congress on the details, and he could imagine this coming out in a way that the large banks feel good about.
Right. And of course, our other good friend Simon Johnson on his blog, Baseline Scenario, was saying—
who's been calling for things like this for a long time.
And he had a blog post that said, "Welcome back, Mr. President," something like that. So they're obviously very supportive of this change in direction for the president.
Although Simon did say, "I'm going to be studying this carefully."
On you like a hawk.
On you like a hawk.
Exactly.
And as will we be. Anyway, I think that wraps it up for us, Alex.
Yes, it does.
Please visit us at npr.org/money. Send us your comments, questions, concerns, photos to planetmoney@npr.org. I'm Adam Davidson.
And I'm Alex Blumberg. Thank you for listening. What you say?